Should I do it?
Let's do it.
All right. We are back. And this time, it isn't a file that one of us forgot about on their desktop.
Yep. Thank God we, thank God for losing sleep over deleting things. So we never delete anything anymore.
I mean, I deleted it. It's a good thing you had it on your.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I was giving it a collective, like, you know, the collective we.
But I will say the collective we are back, the spookiest, scariest, the bloodiest, the most disgusting horror podcast.
Hideous as well.
Where we are a
No, you have spooky. To be nice. Oh. Nope.
I'm just trying out words. We're the horror aficionados, and I've got my Jack Skellington pajama bottoms on. I'm sipping my spiced apple cider with pumpkin spice, and I am just counting the days because spooky season is always around the corner. But it literally is around the corner, but it's always in this house.
That's right. We only get spooky.
We believe in science, doing research, and being a Halloween fan all year long. So,
and that hate has no home in this house.
That's right. Only for people who don't like Halloween. The files are reopened.
Yes, they are.
We went down in the basement, we dusted off the mold and cobwebs, and which we have a lot of because it's spooky always around here. And we batted the bats away and the files are open. And boy, are the files hastily written in this chapter. But
this is going to be, I can't decide. It's hard to tell because I've been going back and listening to them. This might be one of the episodes I annoy you the most. So it could be fun.
The power of editing will keep you, the viewers and listeners.
No, it'll still be succinct. You're just going to be annoyed with how I feel.
One, yes. I mean, as you all know, if you've forgotten, Will is a no stranger to wild hyperbole. So that will be in abundance. Los Angeles.
Oh, wait, let's get in the middle. We got to save it. Remember?
Well, Los Angeles, listen up because we got something for you in the middle.
Yes. Yep. And for those of you that haven't been following along, we finished this journey, what is now almost 6 months ago. Like, we watched everything. We just burned out and life got insane. And so we weren't able to finish recording all of these. So now we're coming back around again. And I'm personally very grateful because revisiting these again 6 months later, I think is a benefit. And I think it'll turn out better than it would have if we recorded them then.
Well, yeah, I mean, we're doing too much. And when you enter, let's say, this phase of Mr. Jess's career, you need the heart and courage of one Alan Quartermain to be able to spelunk these caves. Because if there is any terror in your heart or eyes, you are not going to—it's just not for you. So this takes—
Wow. Did you set that up on purpose for our first film?
Look is that, that? Did I do that?
Dude,
damn. Oh, that segue. Yeah, that's right. This is an area of his filmography that is very not talked about as much as the rest. So that's why we kind of thought maybe we should come at this with fresh eyes rather than tired eyes. Because we got a lot of tired spies.
Well, I just don't want to end up doing... I still, my biggest regret on this journey so far is we did Linda so wrong because we were so burned out when we were going through like 14 films a week. And the way we really don't talk about Linda, I hate it. So I'm glad we gave it this time so we can properly ignore or embrace these movies.
Yeah. Linda rocks. If we were in any way flippant about it, it's because
we were in only ways.
We're a flipping podcast. We're flipping this shit constantly. I'm always flipping stuff. So like, let's
lay it down. Give us the year. Let's go.
We're still in 1983. We right where we left off. We are in 1983, a film that he shot in November of that year. Didn't come out for another 3 years in the summer of 1986 in Madrid. This is a film called Alone Against the Terror. So spooky, but you came to the right people who know about spookies. So we're gonna see if this holds up to the horror jeweler's eye. But this is of the sinister eyes of Dr. Orloff. Also, Nightmares Come at Night. And it has echoes of The Other Side of the Mirror, Virgin Among the Living Dead. Is it as good as those? Well, let's get into it. This is a film. It's just, you know, Lena is, if you've seen Sinister Eyes of Dr. Orloff, it's the exact same plot. Lena is the Cinderella to her two evil stepsisters. She's bedbound. She's having visions of her dead father. And they're basically driving her to commit murder. Unlike in the Sinister Eyes of Dr. Orloff, it was that sinister, awful Dr. Orloff making her do it.
This time, his name's a little different.
He's back, though, but his name's Dr. Orgloff.
No, is it Orgoff or Orgloff? Is there an L?
I don't remember. I think it's Org.
I think it's Orgoff.
Okay, yeah, it's Dr. Orgoff, yeah. And yeah, it's clearly he's not going to call him Dr. Orloff this time. So yeah, this the doctor this time is just a schemer trying to get some money. Although the plot is a little dubious how his scheming's going, because yeah. I'm going to assume that Jess forgot to shoot certain scenes, or those scenes are lost because there are some connective threads missing. But who gives a shit, really? You know.
See, but you basically have this interesting tension between the stepsisters basically existing very much in like a Pedro Almodovar early comedy. That's the kind of thing they're doing. So they're really over the top, just like aggro, shitty people. I love it. I would love an offshoot movie with just them because they're so much fun. But then on the other side, we have an incredibly somber and very sad story and performance from Lena. As before we get too far into it, because it's different than usual, this is a company called Mundial Films who produced this one. And that's these two dudes, Herminio Garcia Calvo and Santiago Moncada. That'll be important later as we talk today, because they also worked on a couple of the other films we're going to get to. And Santiago even wrote a couple that we're going to talk about today. But yeah, this is a brief little foray with a couple guys giving some money to Jess while he continues to battle Golden Films to put out any of the movies.
Yeah. I will say that though I like this movie, I don't think it's perfect. I don't think it's even very good. I think it's pretty good. I think what we have here is the beginning, and I know you're going to disagree with me, so you can ready your response. I think that we are getting further away from his ability to retreat into some of his old haunts. I'm thinking of like Cries of Pleasure as sort of the last kind of attempt at his libertine, murderous libertine lovers, Eugenie sort of thing. And it does a really, really good job of it, but you can sense maybe a boredom starting to creep in, or maybe not even a boredom, but maybe he's just tired. Because listen, Spain's pretty hot, and when they shot a lot of these movies, it was really hot. To the much like the cast and crew would talk about, like, yeah, it was tough. Sometimes you can really sense that on screen. I don't know if that's what we're sensing on screen here. It's just Lena, I feel like, is really underused in this one. I don't know if it's it's like a difference for her. It's just, I think, like, I don't know. I just sense kind of a malaise setting in. That's he's trying to keep it going, and he's definitely doing it better than he's going to do it with some of the other ones. But other than the last kind of like 10 to 15 minutes, you know, I wish the movie had more of that because there is some life that breathes back into it at the very end. But it's like, in my opinion, it's like the worst thing about Sinister Eyes of Dr. Orloff is that 15, 20 minutes into the movie, there's that dialogue between the her and Dr. Orloff that just goes on forever. And it also does in Nightmares Come at Night in that scene in the car, but that scene just oozes with creativity and these low budgets that normally allow Jeff to do a lot more with his imagination. And I think he does a little bit in this one. I think the greatness comes in spots in this movie for me, rather than it kind of being the whole thing.
Yep. Well, you know how I feel. I think this is going to be, once it's restored, one of the considered one of the pretty close to the top ones. When I say close to the top, I mean, you know, top like 70 movies. You know, I'm
Okay,
being big there. But also on that note, I didn't realize this till today, but we definitely will get a restoration because this movie played in 2022 at the Deutsche Film Institute Film Museum Festival on 35 millimeter, which I hadn't realized. But so that's very hopeful because then we'd finally get an actual aspect ratio and not VHS. Because that's one of my big ways into this movie is I do think I'm seeing, because I've watched this so many times, I think I'm seeing the rest of the image that is not there from the VHS. And we'll see if I'm wrong once we actually get, you know, this film restored. But I think the cinematography is gorgeous. I think the blocking is really interesting. I think the lighting's really good. It's mostly natural light, which is you know, it does happen sometimes with Jess, but even the interior stuff. And so it gives it a really strange gothic feel against the not gothic at all sets that are happening in the movie. But I don't think Lena's underused at all. I think this is an experiment in a different style of acting. And to me, the key for this movie being so special, because Lena's whole thing, right? We talked about it with Will Sloan, is that she's such a full-bodied performer, right? It's very physical, it's everything. This time, it's almost her going way, way, way back in film history and just seeing what she can do with those eyes. And towards the beginning of the movie, there's an amazing moment where she's laying in bed, remembering having a conversation with her father, played by Antonio Mayans, who also gives a great performance, where they're talking about that everybody dies, and Lena's tears are just welling up without her face changing at all. And it's beautiful. And that's the first time we've ever seen that from her. And it's like that throughout this whole movie. It's just these small, little, subtle things
I don't think
instead
it's
of.
like it through the whole movie. I think you're right. That scene is good, but I do think your greatest strength is your childlike ability to imagine the movie being exactly what you want it to be. And I think like there's just enough to give someone that feeling. And I don't think it's, I mean, sure, maybe the aspect ratio gets restored. I doubt it's going to be that much on a noticeable level, but it will help when things look better because the thing we're going to like get into with a lot of these movies and even the stinkers, I'm not saying this is a stinker, but the lighting and camera work usually is always pretty good. So, you know, that those are givens. I just think like the thrust of the movie is so close to really like being that final thing. And this is more than a curiosity, this movie. I think this is not a bad movie in his filmography, but I do sense him getting kind of tired and sleepy. And sometimes
I think they're depressed. I think they're very depressed because I think the Golden Film situation really surprised them, even though they'd been down that path so many times before. So I think they're very depressed while they're making this. I do agree. I do agree with that. But for me, it comes through, you know, even just the editing of the murder scenes, I think is excellent. And what should have been silly and schlocky feels very emotionally heavy. I think that's why I dig this so much because it's not quite a bummer, Jess. You know, like obviously we're not getting to like the extreme ones by any stretch, but this is a very melancholy Jess, and I love that shit. But
melancholy. The last 10 minutes, the murder sequence of the sisters is one of the better things he's ever done in terms of horror images and scenes in his.
Do you buy into what Thrower theorizes on a little bit in this one with the, as far as the book that's being read? I think it's interesting. So the normally the books that you see either don't relate to anything or it's just a joke. But this one, he's reading a collection of Borges's short stories, but late period Borges. And that's where Borges talks about, like at that time in his career, he's talking about that he was interested in simplifying his style and getting rid of everything and seeing what was left. And Thrower theorizes that Jess is starting to do that as well, with the weight of not having the money and losing everything they thought they had gained with Golden Films, and that Jess is now experimenting. And so maybe that's influencing me too much on this movie, but I've been thinking about that a lot with all the films we'll talk about today. And it's at least, I think, a worthwhile idea to consider.
I think that's it. I mean, that damn Brit, he can do it like that. Very quick. He's good. Yeah. I mean, that's possible. Cause I do think that theory holds water given some films coming up here. So we give our recommendations to Alone Against the Terror. Will is maybe cheerleading it a little extremely, but that's, you know what? It's the underappreciated stepchild in the, you know, the Jess filmography. So we need lunatics like Will over there saying that.
That's what I'm here for.
All right, moving on. We are the next film shot in 1983, the same month, probably at the exact same time. We have Blood on My Shoes, also with Mundial. And let's see. He's directing under the name Clifford Brown this time.
And it was in November, by the way. It's confirmed that they were shot in the same month.
Right. Yeah, like this is a movie that also is in horrible condition and is only available in a really muddy VHS. Yeah, I mean, this one deals with spies. It's a kind of a remake of Night of Open Sex, playing very soon in a theater near you in Los Angeles. And it's again, you know, him kind of retreating into some of his older terrains. Blood on My Shoes.
I dig this shit.
It's very half baked in terms of Franco. Awake in certain scenes that recall elements of like Wicked Women. It's too little, not enough, in my opinion. But it's,
I get it.
Yeah.
I get it. But I think, again, it's that why I said it at the top, because it's going to come up so much today. We're in this period where I think Jess and Lena are looking back and thinking about everything and whether it was worth it. And we're in Benidorm, same place as we are with like Thong Girls. And we talked about that movie.
We spent some time in Benidorm recently, didn't we?
Yeah, we went to Benidorm. It was pretty cool. We'll tell you about it in hopefully a month or so.
Yeah, you might hear about our trip to Benidorm soon.
Yeah, but this one, similar to Thong Girls, the way this film opens is what really gets me. It's very similar. We are just looking at sad architecture, and it's pretty quiet. And so we just kind of spend time with that before we get going. And so Jess and everybody's just looking at these places that they've become so obsessed with over the years and seeing what's actually there, if anything. Outside of that, I do love the character that Howard Vernon plays, Professor Von Klaus. He's
a bitch-ass sinister barons.
He's funny. I think he's funny in this. It's dumb. It's definitely dumb, and it's pretty tossed off, but I think he's funny. I like the film or the music theory jokes.
He's goofy rather than being funny. Here's also the problem. When Jess shoots for lowbrow comedy, it is really never really hitting the mark. I gotta say, this you do not excel at this, Jess. You excel at these kind of darker satirical views of comedy, but you are not good at doing this screwball. We all love those Mitchell Leeson, Gregory LaCava screwball comedies. We love Carol Lombard and all that. But Lena, you're not that. And Jess, you are not those directors.
Only once. He did it once and that's it.
Which one was that?
Your favorite, Lucky Baby. He nailed it once.
Okay. I'll, you know what? Because we've
okay, I'll wrap
tired it up. From hearing about Lucky the Inscrutable. I'm going to finally give Will, you can have that. You can have it.
It's okay.
Blood on My Shoes. Again, it has some good, he does actually in spots get towards some of that kind of dreamy horror-ness in spots. Don't go expecting the whole movie doing that.
No, even I'm not saying this one is like everyone's missing out. But if you love Jess, you will find plenty to get you through, I would say.
Now, speaking of something that we may not be able to get through together, let's jump into his next film, shot a month later in 1983, Una Rajita para Dos, otherwise known as A Pussy for Two.
Yep. This is credited to Lulu Laverne, which is the name they often put on the hardcore pornos, one of Lena's aliases. This is a brand new company for them. They start working with Farvey Films, which once Spain fully legalized pornography in theaters, these people popped up and hit them up and asked if they would make these movies. And there's a good little interview moment with Antonio Mayans when he's asked about the hardcore movies. He says, honestly, it worked out fine because we would be working on the movies we cared about, and then we would go to lunch, and then after lunch we would shoot pornos because it took an afternoon, and then we would all actually get paid for those because they played so well in theaters. Like this movie had a one of the most successful theatrical runs in its career.
Clearly Spain was suffering from a lot of repression at this time in 1983, and now that hardcore was allowed, they really ate it up. But boy does the film eat your patience up pretty fast.
Yeah, I mean, you'll know what you're getting into the way the film opens, because what we do is Jess and Lena clearly saying, all right, if this is the only thing that'll get us paid, we are going to fucking just give it to you. So it opens on an asshole, not just on an asshole in a close-up like you've seen in lots of porn, a magnifying glass on that asshole while Lena's fingers go in to pull out a microfilm. So you just watch some, that's how this movie starts, is just Lena pulling microfilm out of an asshole in horrific close-up. this kind of in a fun way complicates, as we've talked about lots, that Lena, you know, probably never directed anything. But when she's asked about this stuff, the Farvey films, she says, I don't think I have any talent as a director. No, I don't like any of those at all. I was disappointed. So maybe she did try her hand at the hardcore and was like, nope, because what Jess said was about these films, where the results were distressing. I've never been more eager to retire to a convent or become a Trappist hermit.
I mean, Jess really, really knows how to show you how disinterested he is in shooting porn. And I think
he always does something like that in the movies where he's like, fuck you, this is what you guys like.
Yeah, and this might seem like one of Will's many blind leaps of faith, but I'm going to have to assume that he is willfully making this look stupid, because he's like, yeah, they just like, clearly they've just eaten lunch, he's digesting, you know, like he's,
well, and there's only one person in the whole stable that they worked with the porn films who can get an erection anyway, and it's Jose Amas, our buddy, who also Ryan's talked about. He was like, yeah, he was definitely gay, but he could get hard for anybody. So
that's a bi icon right there. A BIPOC icon.
You really, that's true. Well, yeah, close enough.
If you want to classify a Spanish person.
Yeah, it's true. But yeah, no, this movie, it's a spy shit again. You know, we don't need to get into the plot because it doesn't matter. It's just a lot of really sad pornography. And again, with a lot of half-hard penises, unless it's our boy Jose, who can always get it in.
Moving on.
Yep. Quick stop at a
very quick stop. Go ahead. I know you want to talk about this shit.
So this is a movie called Claire. Franco actually did not make this. But our buddy Joe D'Amato did. And in the past, he had done this before in 1979. Joe D'Amato made a movie called Justine, which combined Midnight Party, Shining Sex, and Julietta 69.
Which, terrible, but at least it had the Julietta 69 footage left, which is the only reason to watch that. And it's as stupid as it is, it's worth that alone just to see what this tantalizing film could have been. Not so in this stop.
So in this, and then for this next one, because D'Amato would often just get hired by people to cut new movies together once porn was legalized. So he gets hired again, and he takes one of our least favorites, Elle Fanteau, the really bad sex comedy from Franco, and then Cocktail Special, which we don't need to rehash. You know how I feel, you know how John feels. And then J'ai Brûlé Departeau, which, great. But then he also combines it with another mashup movie that he himself made called Les Héréditaires Super Porno, which I finally found. I had to sign up to the shady porno website because it's not on any torrent sites. I had to sign up for the shady porno site for a 1 month free membership to see this movie. Not worth it, let me tell you. But hey, I've seen.
Listen, if there's one thing that's worse than a Jess Franco porno, it's a Joe D'Amato porno.
Well, these dudes are the tossed off ones. He did a couple.
I'm not saying that. I'm not counting the softcore. I'm not.
Oh no, there's some hardcore because his nunsploitation hardcore stuff is good.
Such as
fucking Images.
That's not hardcore. I would not.
There's a hardcore cut.
Well, of course, there's always a hardcore cut.
Wait, no, the main one that played because it has that horrific scene we've talked about often in the woods.
That's a horrific scene. Yeah, sure. I don't know. I don't consider that hardcore, but
it literally is hardcore.
I don't think there's that much sex in the movie for it to necessarily.
True, but you know what I mean. You know what I mean.
We're not gonna do this. Listen, maybe we'll get to Mr. D'Amato one day. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. I'm gonna make you watch all those 90s pornos. Have fun.
Boy, I've seen a few and they are tough. Yeah, there's nothing more to say about this. It's something that nobody is gonna bother watching. So even you, I have to do it all. Take a day to go see Beetlejuice.
Just listen to me for once. You know, I never say this. I would not recommend anyone, unless you also can't sleep if you haven't completed an assignment. You do not have to watch these to complete the Franco canon. I promise. It will be okay. And don't sign up to that porn site for D'Amato's super porno movie. It's not super.
No.
Not good.
All right. Speaking of not super, let's move on.
Hackett Manacoa films.
Hackett Manacoa. Yeah, you'd hope with a Manacoa movie he would really let his freak flag fly, but boy, is that flag at half mast for this next one. How much for a spy? How much is a question you're going to be asking yourself through the duration of this? How much can one endure? Yeah, it's shot in January 1984. Yep, in Benidorm, our favorite seaside resort, but yeah, it's another silly spy film.
And one that Jess really loves. When he was talking on back his career, he always enjoyed revisiting this one because him and Lena think it's so funny.
I'm glad they got some fun out of this because they had to have been the only ones having fun with these. But
there's a couple moments. Don't worry. This one is not a good movie. I'm not going to try to convince that it is. If you're enmeshed in this world, the Music Concrete jokes, I think, are funny. Ava Leon is the German spy. She's having a great time, and it's a little infectious. Mayans is having fun. Juan Soler finally gets a lead role. That's kind of it.
Countess Irina comes back, and now she's Countess Irina von Karstein, a reference to the Hammer vampire movies. Why? I don't know. And what does it matter? If he's having fun with it, who cares? I would have loved for that name to mean more to the proceedings of the movie and maybe colored it a bit, but hey.
Yeah. It's really just, if you want to see Juan Soler making fun of Music Concrete musicians, then you will love this movie.
Otherwise, you're going to feel maybe tired, depressed, withdrawn, forlorn. maybe how Jess was feeling, feelings that were certainly bubbling up in him that on his next outing are going to actually find an outlet for expression. And I think this is one of the more surprising films of this period. Which is just a good enough movie, but also is clearly commenting on where he is at right now, how he's feeling about his films, film production in general. This film is called Foul Play in Casablanca, or Juego Sucio en Casablanca.
En Casablanca.
I said in, it just sounded like fun. Sorry that my Spanish is a little more refined.
So by the time we finish, we'll both be fluent.
Fluent in something. But yeah, this is a movie that kind of comes out of nowhere for Jess, along with another movie we're going to talk about today. I think these are kind of these twin, like, it proves that he is not dead in his head, even though what's coming out feels a little limp and he's just doesn't have the same juice. But maybe what he's found is he needed to go inward deeper into his feelings, because this is another movie that I guess deals with it, you can put it in his crime genre. Starts out as beautiful as a Jess movie can start. I think that's one of the best. I can't wait until this movie gets restored.
Oh, God. Yeah.
The music, the mood of that opening scene. Oh, it's perfect. And then where it goes, we're not going to, maybe we should probably talk about the twist, but
we'll talk about it. It's fine. It's fine.
Well,
look, if you have this movie or you don't have it and you want us to send it to you and you want to watch it before you hear us talk on it, please do that. Otherwise, let us tell you why this shit is so special.
Yeah. And on that point, I know we have said, hey, hit us up and we'll send you stuff. We still mean that, but I don't think we anticipated how many people have asked us. So if it's a little slow getting to it, just know we can only do so much, and maybe there are better ways we could figure out maybe putting stuff on a folder somewhere instead of always uploading it. But
oh, I do that. I do that already.
Okay. Will's already speedlined the process. So
I'm getting there, but also just to be clear, I will say this. You know, we love our physical media and we love our buds who work their asses off. If you hit us up to ask us to rip a Blu-ray for you of a movie that you can get, we will say fuck off. Yep, if you hit us up to ask us for a VHS rip that only exists in one place on Earth, you can't see it otherwise, we'll take care of you.
Yeah, you got a deal there. So yeah, do not ask us for anything that you can happily support, because yeah, and times are tough, money is tough, but like never has it been more important to probably support these things. They're going to help us in the Mad Max future coming up. So
well, if y'all want more Jess Franco on disc, buy them.
Yeah, true. Okay, so this movie, we hope, gets a restoration soon. Very quickly, the plot deals with a writer who is really depressed. His writing has not been what he wanted it to be. He's lost all faith in his art and within himself. Now he's on a suicidal down spiral. And he does some things that are, you do not endear you to him right off the bat, and that's an interesting gamble. And I think Thrower compares it to what Fassbender did, and I think that's an interesting way of looking at it, because there's a reason he's doing it this way. But this writer, he's depressed, so one night he meet Radek, our favorite portly man.
Well, kind of. He's got
He's got a different name now, but it's Radek. It's the City Green Street ripoff of Radek. And he goes to he's in Morocco and he goes to a poker game and he's playing poker.
This is after he's tried to kill himself and failed.
Well, yeah, right. So like I'm saying, he was suicidal. He's failed at it. So he decides to go to this game. He wins a bunch of money. At the end of the game, he is drunk, just completely hammered, and he says that, you know, in his mind, he still wants to kill himself. So his deal is, I'm going to write a name on the back of these cards and I'm going to distribute it to the rest of the players at the table. And if you have the card with the writing on it, you have to kill me and you can get all the money I just won. Morning comes, he's hungover. He's like, oh God, what the fuck did I do? Most of us have gone somewhere that we didn't need to go the night before, you know what I'm saying? But not many of us make deals with someone to kill them the next day. So panicked, he goes to the Radic knockoff and says, please, can I
Papa Yule, by the
Papa
way.
Papa Yule, that's it, Papa Yule.
And he's so fantastic. It's great.
Yeah, he's like, Papa Yule, please, Papa, please. I shouldn't have done this. And old Papa Yule's like, don't give a fuck, game on. So now he is dodging assassins for the rest of the movie. This is a plot that has been done before. I think there's a movie with Dave Bautista coming out that is the exact same plot.
Well, there's also, this movie was called Juego Sucio in Panama in 1975. The same guy who wrote it,
right,
wrote this for Jess. Just in case folks don't know, the guy who wrote this, Santiago Moncada, he also wrote Hatchet for the Honeymoon, Cutthroats 9, Corruption of Chris Miller. Incredible CV, even though he also wrote a couple more for Jess that didn't hit like this one does. But
yep. But this is in line, I'd say, with those other, the better ones you just mentioned there. I mean, those are all just fantastic films. And I think, okay, so let's, you can skip ahead right now if you do not want to know what is interesting with this twist. So if you do ask us for this and you want a copy of it, just keep skipping until we, you know, it's okay. So I'm going to try to make it brief here. What is discovered towards the end of the movie, a la Hot Nights of Linda, a la Les Ibranles, we are, or Les Glutonies, sorry. We are in the mind of a story being written by...
That has not happened yet.
That has not happened yet. This is, none of this has happened. What has gone on in the story is a complete fabrication of a novel he's writing, and he has given out to characters who were featured in that novel as their real, as their counterparts in real life. So a lot of the things that seem odd about, but honestly, that seem cinematic that happen in this movie are just what they are, cinematic fabrications. And you can read it as it's Jess having made this movie, and now he's presenting it, you know, to like the people in his real life. I'm sure he's thinking of certain producers.
Oh yeah, this is a pointed film. It's just such a beautiful alchemy that happens, and we're so lucky that him and Santiago hooked up when they did, because a storyteller as skilled as Santiago mixed with Jess's depression and venom, oh my God, what it creates.
Right.
This should not work. This should fall apart. That twist should be stupid.
And it's not a twist in the way where it's like, it was all this. The story continues from there.
Yeah, for a while. Yeah.
So it kind of builds on the tension that the fake story was building on and doesn't really break it. It just kind of like magnifies it. And, you know, the story goes from there, and then we just won't reveal what happens at the end. But it's a really interesting exercise. It's more than a curiosity or even a pretty good. I'd say this is really good in the Jess, in the Jess canon. Like I said, that opening is so hypnotic and seductive of what you want from Jess that you're just, you feel instantly like slipping into that warm bath, you know, the Jess bubble bath.
But then when you're in the bath, you're like, wait a minute, this is a little bit different than last time I was in here, but
it's there's minerals that are like, there are minerals that are help detoxify me. Like it's trying to like help me. It's not just like, you know, gassing me up. It's trying to like sober me up to a certain degree. I mean, this movie really reflects where Jess is at this point. So you have, it works on two levels. It works on that kind of meta level and really just as a welcome addition in the Jess canon that doesn't really rely on, you know, recycling or refurbishing some old tropes. Anyway, we'll come back to this idea soon.
Yes. I just want to mention before we go, we just have to shout out our main guy because he's not huge in the Jess world. Usually William Berger is the main character. He gives an excellent performance. Of course, Antonio Mayans and Muriel Montase, who are always great. Everyone's great in this movie, but it is anchored because if he couldn't pull off convincingly what he needs to, the strength of the screenplay would fall apart.
Yeah, he was shooting a, he was like shooting a Spanish kind of spaghetti Western at the time.
What's it called?
Duccio Tessari. It's like a Zapata or something like that, I'm sure.
Let's see. Tex il Signore degli Abissi. Yeah. And then it was a strike. So there was a strike. And so he went to make this movie with Jess.
He also said it was, so, like I was saying, it was so hot that, you know, they could only shoot for a certain amount of time because the horses would start sweating and everyone just lost all fervor. So, yeah, no, it's cool to see William Berger in this movie. And, yeah, just see something, dare I say, mature.
It really is. And it's, I'm happy Jess did things the way he did most of his career, writing everything himself or just not writing and just figuring it out. But what a beautiful thing when he hooked up with Santiago for this. Cause he didn't have to worry about the story beats cause it was done. And he was like, wait, I can relate to this story. I know how to tell it, but we don't get the Jess problem of forgetting to care to make anything make sense. So beautiful. This is one of our favorites, I think.
I would agree. All right. His next movie
is a sad one.
Lost once again. Although I don't think it's ever shot.
And they shot some.
They shot some, but they weren't able to finish it.
They did not get to finish it. Yeah. And this is the second time they shot it. They tried to shoot this in 1975
with William Berger.
Trying to make Mandinga.
Yeah, well, another Mandinga. Yeah. We can dream. But yeah, William Berger was just in the last one, was supposed to be in the 1975 version. So yeah, this is The Killer Wore Black Stockings. Once again, skunked. How does this keep happening to this movie?
And this one too is especially sad because those of you who've been with us the whole time, this was Jess's chance to do a little bit of a redo of Venus and Furs, except he actually had a black jazz musician as the main character this time, because Commonwealth United was not there to tell him he couldn't have a black main character. So it would have been so interesting to see this. Fuck.
Unfortunately, we won't. And we can just assume it probably would not have been as electric as he probably would have done it in 1975. Because, well, the other movie he made around this time, this one brings me no joy, because let's just say all the elements are there. Some of our favorite characters are back together again. That's right. Those red lips ladies.
This is Monster Mash. I'm going to say we finally get, I don't give a shit about, you know, like the Evil Dead crossovers and stuff everyone wants. Give me Al Pereira versus the red lips.
Right, because we saw him last when he was working for the FBI in Kiss Me Monster. That was the last time they've actually been together.
Yeah.
It's, I think, the first appearance of the career.
Yeah, and then the last time we had him was Camino Solitario.
Yeah, which is...
for this, and then we don't get him again until Al Pereira versus the Alligator Ladies, which we...
Why this hurts so much, because it's our boy, Antonio Mayans. He's Alfredo Pereira. We want to see what he's up to. How much seedier has he gotten?
Yes, and he's playing very effeminate, a very gay character that is very similar to Jess's character in Two Undercover Angels.
Right.
It's such a pleasure to see it happen in theory. Also Karen Dior's playing Countess Arena, but she's named Tina. Right. But she's named Tina to go with Lena's character, Terry, because this is also the first time the Red Lips is really just a solo, because it's pretty much just Lena as Terry. But she's got a bud with her, kind of. But it's really just one red lip, you know, in this. And I guess we didn't even say it. Part of the tragedy of this is it never had a theatrical release. Supposedly it never even got finished. What we have been able to see is a work print. So maybe this movie did have a cut where it was the magic we were hoping for, because this is truly an assembly cut and you can feel it.
Oh, there's clearly no negative of this movie. So
it's so sad though. Oh my God. Cause we even get like the fun that Jess is having with the callbacks to the history of the Red Lips. It even goes so far as like Lena's character Terry plays trumpet calls back to the sax jokes with Janine Reynaud and Rizzoni Yanni in Kiss Me Monster. There's so much fun that's meant to be had here, but we don't get it.
This is what I mean. Everybody seems exhausted. Like, people just seem like they maybe had too much, you know, white wine at lunch, and it's so hot, and they're just going through the motions. And it sometimes when he goes through the motions, magic conjures, but there is a negative amount of magic being conjured here. In fact, it sucks the life out of the room. It's just like, how is it this bad? And again, yeah, I don't even think it's just the copy we've had, because there's plenty of movies we've seen horrible, horrible copies of that you can sense the magic underneath the
mat. I'm grateful we have it, but yeah, it's a bummer. I guess did we even say the title? La Chica de los Labios Rojos.
The Girl with Red Lips.
The Girl with Red Lips.
And that's why we didn't even mention it, because this is just, we don't want to know that. I would prefer this just didn't exist, because it just has all the elements to make it great, and or the characters, and then it's just nothing. So,
I'm glad it exists, but it is sad, because I even yesterday I was like, you know what? Maybe if I give it one more spin, and I, as you said, it was tough, and I felt less strong as a human being after I finished it.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully, we're about to hop in another direction that's much more nourishing.
Much, much more nourishing. And I know this is a major favorite of my co-host right here, and probably a lot of our listeners who are already, you know, schooled in the Jess Academy. This is Bahia Blanca from 1984. Yeah, I mean, what can you say about this movie? It's a lot like Casablanca we talked about. It feels reflective of Jess's state of mind at the time, of a character. One of the characters, there's a lot of characters in this one, but
yes,
one character who's just very browbeaten by everything. And instead of even trying to like turn the movie into an exercise in boredom, you know, there's a shocking amount of like character-driven drama put into this movie.
Nuanced character-driven drama. No one is one note, no matter how quickly they come in and out.
The environments speak to their emotional landscape. I mean, you do wonder, along with Casablanca, where this Jess is sometimes. And maybe, you know, when he puts the Negronis down, he can feel like this, because this movie does feel of a beating heart. And just if you didn't know where he was going with Casablanca, you'd be almost totally sidestepped here. Will, do you want to give us a little quick rundown of the plot? It's a complex plot.
I'll just keep it vague, because it's easier that way. It doesn't matter. So basically, we have this character named Alita, who lives on an island. In my opinion, she is Jess in this movie. I assume that's who you were talking about as well. She lives on this island where she runs a bar. And the only way you can get to it is by ship. And she's close by to this small fishing village where someone gets killed. And then everyone starts going around asking everybody, you know, to try to figure that out. To me, it can be that simple. That's pretty much all you need to set it up.
Is there a supernatural presence on the
side? So they say that this island that she lives on, they call it what, like Mermaid Island or whatever. I forget what they actually call
Day
it.
Or something. Deer Island, I think.
Deer Island, yeah. But the legend is that there are mermaids who are, you know, essentially will seduce you in and kill you or whatever. But this movie, brilliantly on Jess's part, does not commit to any of the supernatural like tinges that kind of float around the whole movie. Instead, like people who often live in these small places separated from society, he just lets those myths and those beliefs do what they're going to do with each person. And the movie itself is not engaging with them, but it's also not saying they don't exist. And it gives such an incredible aura to this film.
Yeah, I think this is a good example of, if people say Jess could never craft a good dramatic plot. I think this and Casablanca completely throw water on that idea. I mean, I will say it does sound like we're talking about a movie that's just a 180. I mean, it still feels like a Jess movie. Like it's, there's still a kind of laziness to it, but I don't know if that's necessarily, I don't think it's by design necessarily, but it's a fault that's happening at this time that's actually working for the movie, whether it's by design or not. The cinematography still feels a little tired. Like he still feels a little like, I'm not going to do too many setups. It's hot. But I don't know. It just all really works with this movie, and it just gives you this kind of, you know, like the other one, this like kind of hungover feeling. If the rest of Jess's filmography is a drunken bacchanal, you know, this is like that next morning. The imagery, oh, it's a gorgeous movie.
Well, and I think as well, it's them letting themselves take a breath while they're floundering, trying to figure everything out in this weird career. And I think it all comes down to that character, Alita, kind of what she's talking about, in direct ways and indirect ways throughout the whole film, is just musing about her life and aging and whether she's done anything worthwhile and whether all the stuff that she's committed to, including taking care of Lena's character, who's mute.
House of Linda.
Also, we have some other side of the mirror in this film as well with how it ends. I won't spoil it, but
oh, that's right. Yeah, there is.
It's very. Yeah. I guess I wanted to read, if it's cool with you, I think Thrower, this is maybe one of my favorite pieces of his writing. What he says towards the end of this write-up. He's talking about one of the final images of the movie. So he says, it's a striking image, too, because it adds something new to the lexicon of symbolism in Franco's treatment of the sea. In his fantastical films, the sea represents a boundary, a liminal space between one realm and another, like the hypnagogic state between wakefulness and sleep. And in the sex and horror pictures, it's an erotic symbol, hovering at the brink of pleasure or disillusion. In Bahia Blanca, the sea becomes the medium of detachment, of separation, across which characters struggle to build relationships. Beautiful.
Well said. I mean, yeah. Really well said. Yeah, no, I mean, this is a beautiful movie that is out of print, unfortunately, from Severin, unless you come to maybe some of our pop-ups. You never know. You never know what's going to pop up at our pop-ups. So,
and hey, maybe we'll finally get to show this one, because I forgot until I was going through this morning that this one had no theatrical release.
It did, yeah, no theatrical release, which is weird for this one to have been the one to not get a theatrical release. But
I mean, it makes sense at the time, though, because we're still in slasher boom. We're in the porno boom. And Jess was like, hey, I made a contemplative, quiet film about wondering if all of the stuff we all do together is worth it. What do you guys think? And everyone's like, no, man, we're good.
Yeah.
He's like, no, but it's like Ava Leone's greatest thing she's done for me, but okay.
Closing, we will say what does also kind of help the maturity of this movie is that according to people in the know, this was Jess's tribute to Johnny Guitar, the Nicholas Ray film. You can certainly see the character of Alita being the Joan Crawford Vienna character and her bar kind of just whittling away the days, you know, regrets of the past. I suppose Mercedes McCambridge's Emma is also represented in it. I'm sure Turkey's in there too.
Yeah, I think we should hang out and watch these together one day and then just get stoned and draw it out. I think it'd be fun.
As the Johnny Guitar poster hovers right next to me.
Yep. Always a movie,
a movie I love too much. But anyway, moving on to something unreleased that, my God.
Ugh.
Another, just when you think like maybe everything that became unreleased from him at this point was probably just some frivolous, dumb sex comedy or hardcore porno. Nope. Unfortunately, in 1984, there's a film called Voices of Death, which is a finished film, according to Jess, shot with Golden Films and Manacoa, a co-production.
Yeah.
What the fuck? But it's like, from what, based off of what we know, it's a giallo, probably would have been close to Night of the Skull, but a reimagining of a virgin among the living dead. Oh, God.
Yep. Well, instead of crying about this existing, let's move on to another one that does.
That's hard to move past.
I know. It's
out there. That this movie is somewhere in some weird basement or somewhere.
It was Francesco Cesari, who works for the Spanish Film Archives, I guess, who told Schroer that based upon paperwork he had unearthed in pretty recent years, was like, no, this is a Virgin Among the Living Dead remake. That's what it, for, based on this stuff. And we're like, oh, cool. We'll just go be dead until you find it.
Yeah, I mean, and also that it's a loose adaptation of Edgar Wallace's The Case of the Frightened Lady. So,
well, I don't trust that, though, because we know what happens when Jess...
It's not close enough, but we just know that it's probably in that kind of ambient gothic giallo of Night of the Skull, probably, but... So if anyone wants to find that, had to get a lead on
that. Yeah, that one's in the top three that we need saved the most, for sure.
Yeah. But here's what we do have. Instead of that, we have Last of the Philippine Women. And boy, do I wish it was the last, but it isn't.
This is us climbing into the Spanish-American War of 1896. Which he covers the war in about 3 minutes. So kudos for that, I guess.
The cheapest way to do it. And I got to say, I'm kind of here for it.
The opening is pretty awesome. It's a good time.
It's something. You're not going to be wowed, but you will be kind of wowed at the ingenuity of level of cheapness on display.
Well, and you'll be wowed, especially with what follows for the most part. So you'll definitely wish you were back at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Another one written by Santiago Moncada somehow. I don't know how he did that one. And also Carlos Aguilar, which I imagine our listeners are familiar with, but he was a film critic. He wrote Morpho fanzines, and he also wrote the Jess Franco book El Sexo del Horror from 1999, which is way out of print, but very interesting. He assistant directed this movie and two of the others we'll talk about.
Yeah, this is kind of in a 15-year-old captain territory.
Yes. And Blue Lagoon, Lake of the Virgins, Sexy Darlings, Robinson, Tempestuous Slaves. If you watch those and were like, yeah, I'd like to take a dip back in that shallow, shallow pool.
Yeah, that's as shallow as like the pool inside of a lizard's cage.
It's true. It's like
a little puddle that you can splash around.
It's a fucking pimble. Yeah.
Yeah. It's
like some water, kind of, but
I really don't even want to go into this one. I hate it. Lena is obnoxious in it.
Yeah, it's just like, Lena runs from the war, the very real Spanish-American war, but takes Antonio Mayan's children yet again. They go to an island. They meet some people. Lena decides she has to marry this old dude and clean him up. She makes him take a bath at gunpoint. There's one thing that I think is funny in this whole movie, and it is when Lena forces this old man to marry her because she decides they have to do that to, I guess, I don't know, restart the population or some shit in case the world ends. At the marriage, instead of a Bible, they are reading Kant's Critique of Pure Reason, which is what they're pulling from. So that's kind of funny. There's a red dream sequence that I guess could be interesting, but probably not.
Could be, but it isn't. Yeah.
This is one of the few that even I really can't pull much from, except I guess just if I were in the mood to watch Lena be beautiful, because she's that. Or if you want to watch a real snake crawl across four people sleeping for almost 12 minutes.
Yeah.
That fucking scene. I was like, guys,
you're clearly bored. And
it's just crazy. This fucking snake just keeps crawling while the old dude just keeps watching him sleeping. Oh my God. And then they do it again. They come back to it one more time.
Yeah, they really pad it out. There's a chimp, though. There's a chimpanzee back.
There is a chimp, but he doesn't get to do that much.
Not smoking this time, unfortunately.
This is absolutely only for completists.
Yeah, and even then I say, be sure that you labeled yourself a completist. Okay, well, let's take a trip. Maybe a trip to Bangkok, coffee included? No, that's not what I was just... That's not something I'm saying. That's the name of the movie. Trip to Bangkok, coffin included, which kind of sounds like a spaghetti western almost.
Yeah, it sounds like a Django movie.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds like a Django. Django, go get him and kill him, please. Coffin included.
In Bangkok.
In Bangkok. Yeah. Viaje a Bangkok a todo incluido, which translates to what I just told you. I don't know why I just read it then.
We're practicing our Spanish.
Yeah, this is I will say, I'm going to label this one a curiosity.
Yeah, I dig this one. I for jazz heads, you'll have a good ass time. Mm-hmm. If you watched, if you like me, like Attack of the Robots a lot more than John does, and you said, man, that weird pigment thing they did where they made white people not white and made them do evil stuff. It's back again.
Yeah.
It might be cooler.
Well, it makes me wish I was watching Attack of the Robots. I'll tell you that much. But I don't dislike this movie. I just, I don't know. You know, Eve. So.
Set it up. Give us a little setup.
I'm trying to think of it. There's a colonel of the British Empire named Daniel J. Blimp, otherwise known as Colonel Blimp, which, hey, Jess loves the Archers. Who doesn't? But,
and he loves putting Daniel J. White tributes in anywhere he can. So he combined the Archers with his composer and then said, Howard Vernon, what are you up to?
Yeah, no, this is people are looking for a secret. I don't even remember what it's like. Is this the one where people shit themselves?
Yeah.
Yeah. They're looking for something.
I have the quote. Everyone will suffer from super diarrhea with deadly effects. I know because I tried these herbs and now I'm shitting to death.
Yeah. Which is, that's a great. Yeah, no, that is good. I like that. I like that we are with what?
I was going to say Master Tao, who's Cagliostro stand in. He's psychic.
Fu Manchu. Yeah, he's kind of a Fu Manchu Cagliostro sort of.
Or Captain Planet, because his goal is to save the Earth because he's so upset that humans are destroying it, which is another fun layer to this movie.
Which is funny that he wants something that's going to make them defecate themselves to death, because I tell you, a beautiful world is not going to be very beautiful when everyone's dead, rotting on the ground with mounds of diarrhea everywhere.
I mean, you can just scoop them into piles, though, and then you go to an island.
I mean, he can possess people, so he could get a nice cleanup crew to come wipe it away.
Yeah.
No, I mean, there's things, again, this one has definitely elements that keep you, like, it's like you're on an operating table, you've been declared dead, mostly dead, but the doctor keeps hitting you with the paddles just a little bit to be like, oh, you're alive. And then you suddenly start going dead again. And then they paddle you again. I'd say that's the vibe of this movie.
Yes. Except in my opinion, the last 15 or so, we've come back to life.
It worked.
Paddles finally worked.
A trend we're seeing in these movies where the last 10 to 15 minutes, like, it's like, where was this?
Yeah, which is atypical up to this point in his career, because sometimes Jess does not stick the landing when he otherwise gave us a Stone Cold masterpiece. So it's interesting.
Yeah, well, it's got people being controlled to do crimes. You know, Howard Vernon's goofy fucking Colonel Blimp ass mustache, you know.
Also, he rants about there's some good stuff in here. What we're talking about with Jess being sad and reflective is Colonel Blimp has a rant about tourism. And like skyscrapers destroying these beautiful places, which again, very much Thong Girls, very much Blood on My Shoes, a lot of this stuff. So he's getting those things in.
Yeah, we got Thong Girls on the mind. That's interesting.
Hopefully this one, I will say this one and the next one, while the other Bangkok we'll talk about, hopefully these see the light of day sometime. Because I do think this movie might actually sing if we could see it looking a little better.
Well, before we get to his second trip to Bangkok, LA, Los Angeles, City of Angels, city where dreams are made. We are coming to make those dreams next week, starting on September 16th, a Monday, at with our buds at Cinematic Void at the Los Feliz 3. We are going to be showing Vampiros Lesbos, and I hope you got your tickets because it's sold out. So that's unfortunate for the people that were slow pokes, but the fun doesn't have to end there. In fact, Vampiros Lesbos is the Beatles of the Jess Franco canon. Yes, we all know it. It works every time. But there is so much more, and you cannot just end it at Vampiros Lesbos because it has that catchy, you know, letterbox ready title. There is so much more. So on Tuesday, September 17th, we are going to be at Braindead Studios, Fairfax. We are going to be showing Bloody Moon, along with one we are both could not be more excited to share.
I know.
One of our favorites in the crime genre of Jess, Night of Open Sex. You're going to hear our favorite song in the world with a group of people. You are going to get a taste of our minds that night.
Good job.
And so that's going to be a really fun night. So, and Bloody Moon, I mean, what else do you need to say about Bloody Moon? It's his interpretation of slashers. I mean, who wouldn't? Yeah. More exciting. It's good you ask that, Will, because on September 18th, Wednesday, probably next to what we did in New York at Spectacle, might be one of the most fun things that we've shown. I still can't believe we're doing it, but this is probably going to be the U.S. premiere of this movie at Whammy Analog. We're getting in the spirit with their SOV month. We're showing Snake Woman, his 2005 shot on video reimagining of Vampiros Lesbos.
All right, so if you did get your tickets for Vampiros, go and get your tickets for the not first, not second, not third, not fourth time he remade the movie, but a really cool one that no one has seen and definitely not with other humans.
I am really excited to see how that movie, because, I mean, no one writes about that movie. Nobody talks about that movie. I mean, eventually we'll get to his SOV period, but what's interesting is that is such a wasteland, or considered to be such a wasteland, that a movie like Snake Woman is just not going to make its presence known. But I think it's pretty damn good. And
you guys listening know what the truth is. There is no such thing as a full-on wasteland in the career of Jess. There was never a period that didn't at least have some shit going on. And we are going to remind everyone that that includes the SOV period.
Yeah, so if you were a little feeling down about when we got to the SOV period, don't get too down.
No, there's some good stuff in there. And what are we doing on Thursday?
Thursday, September 18th, we are going to be at Cinephile Video doing a pop-up.
19th,
whatever, gives a shit.
19th from 4 p.m. to 8 p.m. And we are bringing the fucking goods, let us just say.
Yeah, there will be stuff for sale at the other shows, but this, we are saving a lot of the goodies for this special event.
Yeah, because you know we fucking love video stores, and we love to celebrate the ones that are still going. And Cinephile rules. Obviously, you've been there if you live in L.A. If somehow you haven't, we won't shame you, but make this your first time. Come through. And then
chat with Friday, you can chat shit with us, you know.
That's right. And then Friday, we are doing something pretty fucking special.
All right. This has got to be the most exciting one, personally, for me. And I know you just really hyped up Snake Woman. Well, yeah, because that never plays, and that's crazy. But
you guys didn't know we were fans of Jess Franco, so forgive us for getting excited every time we get to show stuff.
But this one is the one that I would say, if you make one stop, you got to come to this. It's another double feature, and we are showing one of our absolute favorites, one of the top tier films in the pantheon of Jess, rarely ever shows. We are showing Venus and Furs.
Okay.
If you're listening to this podcast and you don't know what that is, then you shouldn't keep listening. Because I don't know what else to, like, you're gonna get very lost, because that's a fixture in the whole point of this series we've been doing here. Venus and Furs. What else can you say? Brilliant, beautiful movie. We're gonna show that with another film of his, the very classically constructed The Other Side of the Mirror. One of those Jess films that you think he probably couldn't deliver something of this nature, but boy, what a, in another world, that would be an art house classic.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is a 2220 Arts, and this is with our good friends over at Acropolis Cinema. That's going to be an amazing show. As you guys saw, Vampiros Lesbos already sold out. The rest will be quickly behind it. So grab your tickets now.
Yeah, and especially if you need it. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Oh, you're good. Oh, good.
I don't know what you said, but it was probably good.
Oh, I just said, and we'll see you in LA soon.
And that too. Yeah, I just wanted to add, if you're going to these brain dead Pedro Almodovar shows, and you wonder why this Jess movie is popping up right there, let me stop you. You're still celebrating Pedro with this selection, because Pedro loved Jess 1. He most certainly loved Night of Open Sex, like, without a doubt.
Oh.
But also, Bloody Moon is featured in Matador.
Alongside Mario Bava, my guys. That's what Almodovar said. He was like, look, these freaks in my movie, they'd be fucking, and they'd be fucking DeFranco, and they'd be fucking to Bava.
So there it is. Yeah, right. So there it is. You can't go to Vampiros Lesbos if you got the tickets. Brain Dead, Bloody Moon, Night of Open Sex on Tuesday. Wednesday, Whammy, Snake Woman. Thursday, Cinephile Video pop-up. Come hang with your boys. And Friday, 2200 Arts, Acropolis Cinema, Venus and Furs, The Other Side of the Mirror.
I'm sorry. Because we said 2200 too many times.
Oh, 2220.
Which is conveniently the address of the place. So make sure you go to 2220 and not 2200.
Yeah. Maybe make it less difficult, motherfuckers. But
all right. Otherwise, just real quick, the only thing that will be announced soon, our next Bloody Brunch at the Davis Theater here in Chicago is going to be on September 29th. That'll be, you know, like last time, probably a little earlier, maybe an 11:30 a.m. or maybe even a little later, maybe a 1 p.m. start time. We'll see what's going to happen. It'll be announced soon with House on Sorority Row. That'll be the lovely new restoration. It's going to be great. Otherwise, strap in, because we will be announcing a shit ton of fucking screening soon. Yeah. I guess including T.R. Baskin the day after.
Yeah, T.R. Baskin.
T.R. Baskin with a filmed introduction from our buddy Larry Karaszewski. Also, we'll be doing a Q&A after the film with film critic and just all around good ass human being, Kat Sachs. So it's going to be a great night, and it's fucking free. Hit our link free. You can just RSVP to it, and then you just show up. It's free.
Yeah, that's going to be really fun. T.R. Baskin, awesome horror movie. We're a horror podcast. We love horror movies. T.R. Baskin.
That's the scariest shit, man.
Yeah, light your pumpkins for T.R. Baskin.
Yeah, get ready, because actually our Larry's intro and our intro is mostly focused on connecting the Terrifier films and their true lineage from T.R. Baskin to that. So, Damien, we see you, and we're calling you out.
Yeah, we also got the Winnie the Pooh Blood and Honey movies.
All right. Wait, okay, we have to go to a meeting like right now. So
let's move on.
Right, let's go back to Bangkok. So the second film in the Bangkok series, I'll say it in Spanish, then you can translate it. Bangkok Cita con la Muerta.
Which translates to Bangkok Dangerous. This is the first Bangkok Dangerous. Sorry. I know, we do need to get to a meeting. Okay.
Look, Bangkok, okay. City of the Dead.
Yeah.
That's it. So
that's what it is.
This is one of the few times I will take an opportunity to, not that he's listening, of course not, because he doesn't need to. He already wrote the books. If Thrower were listening to this and would come on the show, I would take him to task over his write-up on this, because he was clearly, just like Jess is right now in this career, exhausted. And instead of writing anything about the film, he just writes about how shitty the copy is that he's able to see, and then he's mad about it, which is, you know, it's funny and it's endearing in a certain way. But even though this definitely is the worst of the two films, I think there's interesting shit here, and it will help when we hopefully can actually see it. All I will say, similar plot to the others, it doesn't really matter. It's this kind of spy crime film thing we're living in, except this time it's a gang of pirates trying to get the goods. And what keeps me going in this movie is Lena as a pirate, even on the worst VHS copy ever. Boy, howdy. And she does a good, we finally get another good Lena dance in this one. We get Lucky the Inscrutable speech bubbles to start the movie. We haven't done that in a while. And our bodybuilder, yet again, from Thong Girls, our boy is back.
We do love that.
Yeah, and so it's, you know, this movie happened because Jess sent Juan Soler by himself to Bangkok and Pattaya with some film and no camera and told him to figure it out and shoot a bunch of stuff so then they could build it into a movie and let Lena be a pirate. What do you this one, John?
I think when it looks better we'll be able to appreciate some of the lighting of the interiors. Other than that, I think it's
fine. I don't think this is one of the abysmal ones or anything. It's a pretty good time. There's some funny moments. I will say I might miss the look of the VHS because I'm curious what this movie is supposed to look like, because Thrower is correct that the VHS does add like weird pink and blue neon colors that smear over the whole thing, and I'm curious to see what it was meant to look like.
I'm gonna just say I don't give a shit enough about this limp ass story until I get to see it look better. But yeah, adventure movies and spy movies on a budget of this scale, stuff, let's just say that's tough, choppy waters.
Yes, so we are going to move on to another one. I'll be real quick on this because this is similar to a Claire situation. This is a movie Jess was trying to make called Gentes del Rio, which is River People.
It was also called We Must Kill Klaus.
Yeah, which is cool.
I like that name.
That's a cooler name than River People. Mm-hmm. So they were trying to make this movie. Things kind of fell apart. Eurocine took it away from Jess, and eventually Andrea Bianchi, I won't say directed, but I'll say Andrea Bianchi finished,
put his name
and called it Angel of Death. Everyone's there. Howard Vernon's there. Antonio Mines is there. Everyone you know and love from the Jess stable is there. But you can absolutely tell that Jess did not direct this movie, because even Jess's painful outings, you know, we at least talk about them. This is and I like Bianchi more than I should, but this is
an awful
movie.
Yeah, none of the fun of Burial Ground is there, or Malimba. This is bad. It's a bad movie, and it's unfortunate because it's Howard Vernon playing Joseph Mengele, which, you know, all our Nazi heads out there, we see and salute you. But you know, you know about this guy. The guy experimented on twins. He's a bad man. So we're not gonna know what that is, but don't worry, he will get into Joseph Mengele eventually.
Yes.
Coming up here, we have another one, another unreleased movie, very, very quickly shot at Golden Films. And I can relate to the title of this. It was called One of the Chinese. So we don't know.
I love the idea of never explaining that again, so that people who are being so kind as to finally check us out are like, what the fuck? And they're going to have to go back almost to the beginning to find out about that joke that's only funny for us.
You're going to have to go back and get into the lore. Kind of like there's a new movie coming out with Olivia Wilde and Cooper Hoffman that is, I actually signed the rights away to.
Yeah, because it is about John's capital T trauma.
Yeah, and my favorite brat, she's in it, baby. So,
is she playing you?
No, Cooper Hoffman's playing me.
Okay, I wasn't sure. You never know these days.
Well, we've been gone for a while because I had Cooper Hoffman come over and I kind of showed him all the places where I would like cry if I thought about the past, or the sinks I would throw up in if it got too much. You know, And then just kind of how, like, when a door would accidentally, like, graze my ass when I was go through it, about how it would both repel and excite me.
Yeah, just remember, if you are still, and it's not your fault, most people are in this boat. If you are still of the mind that Olivia Wilde should not be canceled, dig back into the Oscar bait archives and find out why she should be.
Yeah, why don't one of you journalists buy this guy a drink and let him tell you his sorrows about growing up under a wild sign. Okay.
Okay, and to finish,
because we're literally getting texts about the meeting right now.
Yes. Last thing, we're gonna do one more Santiago movie. Another script that wasn't good.
It's very bad. Let's just cut through the fat. It's a bad movie. La Esclava Blanca, The White Slave.
Yes, the only two things to enjoy in this for me. We do get to see Jess's favorite haunt in Benidorm, the Talk of the Coast. That was their favorite spot to hang and probably swing and meet all their friends and shit. And then also a thing that Jess loves to do that I talked about at the very beginning of the Frankel Files and John Wisely told me to quit, but I'm bringing it back. Guess what? There's a fucking parrot and his voice dubbed by Jess Franco, because he never misses the chance to be the parrot.
Coming up next in the rest of this, there will be two more episodes. Watch out for him. We are going to round out the rest of his film career, and then we are going to dive into the SOB films. So the two final chapters of the Franco Files, we can finally close this thing for good. So until...
And just to keep you on the line, the next one, the first film we're going to talk about, finally, I know y'all been fucking waiting, Lulu's Talking Asshole, finally here.
Yeah, we know you've been waiting for Lulu's Talking Asshole, and we have too. So until then, goodbye.